Actually, I think this is such a loaded statement that anybody who's been doing homelessness research really gets this title. The challenges of and returns from large-scale longitudinal studies with single homeless people. I just don't even know where to start with a title like that. This is going to be a great one. Tony Warnes is Emeritus Professor of Social Gerontology at the University of Sheffield in the UK. He was director of the Sheffield Institute for Studies on Aging during 1999 to 2005, the chair of the British Society of Gerontology during 1994 to 2000, and the editor of Aging and Society in the last decade. He has published 86 peer-reviewed papers and 23 books, so pay attention. Tony Warnes and Maureen Crane were awarded an ESRC grant to undertake a longitudinal study of resettlement outcomes for homeless people, the Four Home Study, it's called. The study is the largest of its kind in the UK and involved following up 400 single homeless people in London, Nottinghamshire, I'm sure I'm butchering that pronunciation, Leeds, and Sheffield for 18 months after they were rehoused.
Thank you, Ben. First, I'd like to thank Ben and the caucus for selecting this paper for the symposium. We're delighted to have the opportunity. We hope that some of what we say is of interest and that I'm not just sort of telling you things you already know. First of all, I should apologise that Maureen Crane is not here. Unfortunately, her mother is very ill and she couldn't make it. I've no financial relationships. What I try to do in this very short presentation is cover these four things, just tell you something very quickly about the Four Home Study itself, then some main features of the methodology and how we did it, design and how we did it. My views about what some of those returns have been, from the large sample and the longitudinal design. And the last couple of slides are a few points for discussion about how researchers could overcome some of the difficulties of raising large grants for homelessness research. It's very difficult in the UK, I'm sure it is here. The aims of For Home in two lines. We wanted to look at the resettlement process, at the experiences of people when they were resettled into independent housing. These are returns to conventional living. They were responsible for all their financial transactions, paying the rent and so on. There was no support at these houses necessarily. And we wanted to look at the outcomes and the factors that influence the outcomes. The study took a long time to design and get funded. We were about 5 years designing it, and we went to three successive funders before we actually got the money. These are the six organisations in the UK. The names probably don't mean much to you, but they're all non-profits. Four in London, one St Anne's in Leeds and Sheffield, and one Framework in Nottingham. And they really did participate closely in the design and, as you'll hear, the execution of the study. The main features of the design was that we wanted to do a large sample because we know about the variability of homeless people and their experience. We also wanted to represent different parts of England. One of the very strong features about homelessness in the UK is that in London there's a lot more of it than anywhere else, and there's a lot more services, and the housing market is different. Lots of things are different in London, so we needed to look at both London and the provinces. We were keen to do a longitudinal study, partly because our previous studies of resettlement had showed a peak of failures in the very first days and weeks. And we wanted to see if that continued. We wanted to look at the temporal distribution of failures of the resettlement process. So we were going to conduct three waves of interviews: immediately before the person was resettled, after 6 months, and after 15/18 months. I'll explain that strange duality in a moment. We also got the key worker, it should be the key worker there, the person who most closely worked with the person being resettled in the hostel, normally most of them were resettled from hostels, to complete a questionnaire at baseline. Okay. So as you get some idea of the coverage of the study, those are the three major cities outside London that we drew the sample from. So it includes three medium-sized cities, industrial histories and backgrounds, as well as London. We are concentrating here on methodological issues. We have published a final report of the study. This is it. It's 150 pages, actually, full of descriptive findings, but also a lot of practice discussion and policy discussion. So it's available online. All these slides will be available to you, but if you take the title and Crane Warns and Coward, I'm sure you can get to it very quickly. A couple of slides just on the participants or the sample. As you can see, there was more men than women. We had all ages from 17 to, I think, 81. Person being resettled from a hostel into independent accommodation. The ethnicity was very variegated, reflecting the British population at the present time, and the usual kind of prevalence of mental health problems, alcohol problems, and drug problems. Presentation is necessarily very selective and also quite candid. I'm going to tell you some of the things that went wrong, as well as speculate about some of the strengths of the design. First, we set out to test a theoretical model that resettlement outcomes are a function of those four things, which I think you can read. We wanted to gather information about all these four things. We didn't do complete housing histories or complete histories of homelessness. For some people, that would be lots of episodes, of course. But we wanted something about their biographical backgrounds. We wanted something about the help that they received from becoming homeless to the point of resettlement. And we wanted something about the accommodation they were being resettled into, obviously, its quality, size, cost, and so on, location, neighbourhood. And we wanted also to collect information about people's experiences once they were resettled. As you'll hear, transitions after people resettle, having a baby, getting into work, getting out of work, going into full-time education, coming out of all these things, a tremendous impact on people's lives when you're on very low incomes. I mentioned that we found in previous studies this peak of abandonments in the first weeks, one of the justifications for doing the longitudinal study. The odd thing is that in this study, we found no such peak. We found, in fact, no temporal pattern, just a steady number of failures month by month. The rate of failure hardly changed throughout the 18 months of the period. Now, this actually in itself is a commendation of the improvements in resettlement preparation and practice in the UK, because what used to happen was that people were being resettled into accommodation that wasn't ready, that the amenities weren't working, the utilities weren't working, it was damp or whatever. And this isn't happening now. The pre-inspection, I've seen the phrase, pre-resettlement inspection is much better. And so this has solved the problem of early failures. Okay. We were also very keen to get, as far as we could, a representative sample for all sorts of reasons that I probably don't need to explain to you. But there is no collation of data about homeless people in the UK. I'm talking here mainly about single homeless people rather than family homelessness. But amazingly, although there have been funding programs for decades, there is no single collation of the characteristics of people who receive services from single homeless people. So the first thing was we had to get the six organizations to put together a profile of the people they resettled in 2006. We used that to quota our sample, that was very important, as you will hear. Each organisation appointed a link worker to coordinate the organisation's contribution to the recruitment. And they actually got a little resource. The organisations got paid a very small amount for doing that. What we found was that resettlement was much slower than expected and required. And this was interesting in itself. Some residents being resettled by the six organisations were being missed. This was found to be because the importance of the study was not being communicated throughout the organisation. Some of these organisations had 20 hostels, and they weren't spreading the news through the whole organisation, and we had to really work very hard with them, with the management, to educate and persuade and get all the staff across the organisation to feel ownership in the project and to participate in the recruitment. Okay, the lesson for future studies is that if you want to use organisations to help recruit into a study, you have to work very hard to make sure that the staff are on board and play their part. We extended recruitment for 3 months, which is why some people had their last interview after only 15 months rather than 18. We were also very keen to minimise attrition. About one third of the participants were very difficult to engage, and Maureen Crane and our interviewers, who were very dedicated and had worked in the homelessness sector, really did go beyond the call of duty to persuade, to keep calling people, to make repeated visits and so on. And you must budget for this in a study. There's a lot of visits that will be unsuccessful. Maureen would go and do an interview on a Sunday morning or at 9 o'clock in the evening for someone who's at college or in work. So you really do need an exceptionally dedicated team if you're going to minimise attrition. You also need intensive, frequent tracking. There isn't time to talk about what we did there. We actually went to see Paul Toro in Detroit, who had gave us a day's course on tracking, which was extremely valuable. We were very keen to do in-depth interviews. They are semi-structured. They cover a lot of topics. But Maureen began with ethnographic research, essentially, on older homeless people, and we had lots of open-ended questions. Lots of other aspects to that. We worked hard at building up trust. We tried to use a personal approach as far as we could. We searched hard for a standard housing satisfaction scale that would be applicable to homeless people, and we didn't find one. So we've developed our own. Okay, there's lots of things to read there, but these are some of the ways in which we tried to maximise both the reliability and the quality of the information. What are the returns? Well, very, very quickly, a low attrition rate. If you read those figures, I think they are pretty good compared to many of our previous studies. At 6 months, only 4.5% of the sample we couldn't interview because of refusals or they just didn't show. And at 15 to 18 months, 7.1%. This was the return from the very intensive effort in tracking and in keeping in touch with people. We have got a data set now with over 2,000 variables, which is fun, including a lot of the responses to the open-ended questions which have been coded up. I could probably spend 10 minutes on not just these four topics, but another four or more of the things that we feel have come back from all this effort. And I think there may be time just to talk about two. I'm going to choose the second first because it was interestingly mentioned by the previous speaker. One of the things that it's partly a function of the social security system in the UK and housing subsidy and all sorts of things is that when people are in the homelessness services system, they are actually quite, well, they're not generously supported, they don't have high incomes, but they don't actually have much responsibility for their own personal finances. They don't pay their rent. They don't pay the property tax. They don't pay the heating and so on and so on. And one of the things we found is that when people are resettled into independent living, this is a great challenge for many people. Now, hostels for ages have taught basic budgeting skills, of course, and how to use different systems for buying electricity or whatever. But what they don't do is go a little step further and talk about personal financial planning. Have you got the income to move to that area? Have you got the income to go into that course and pay the fees? And this is the thing which really is causing a lot of stress amongst many people who are resettled. Becoming financially independent is, I think, a bigger challenge than many people in the homelessness services in the UK have realised. And when we ask the staff, why don't you give them more training in this, that and the other, say, well, we don't have the skills and we don't have the time. And I think this is something we need to address in the UK. We've done a paper already on the increase in debts in the European Journal of Homelessness. But this is the way in which debts increased by age group. The two columns, the left one 6 months, the right hand one 15 to 18 months. And you can see that for all age groups, debts increased massively over that period, and particularly for very young people. And this caused a lot of stress, and I think it is an issue. It's not entirely unexpected. Now, when people move from being in a financially protected setting into independence, they begin to be more like the rest of us and start borrowing money to buy a television or to buy a refrigerator or whatever. So it's in a sign of becoming more independent, but it also causes a lot of stress. Couple of slides about what seemed to us to be some of the headlines about practice and our practice recommendations. We feel that in the UK, resettlement preparation should give more attention to the problem of being without basic furniture, including a bed and a cooker, when people first move in. This is still a problem, finding people sleeping on the floor for weeks. Training in the skills of weekly budgeting and personal financing. I haven't talked about tenancy support, but this is crazy at the moment because it's not being allocated on the basis of need for support, but according to which pathway you came into the service system. This slide is about how beneficial it's been working so closely with the collaborating organisations and how that's enabled us to get the findings. We talk about impact very much of research in the UK these days. We've been able to get the findings to the government and to quite important national committees very quickly through the help of the collaborating organisations. And finally, some tips for those who'd like to get involved in setting up a large study. some pretty obvious things. Don't just study one city or one homeless population. Design the study in collaboration with provider agencies. Make it as practice relevant as you can, but at the same time, make sure you've got strong academic objectives. If that is if you want blue skies research grants. Emphasize efficiency, effectiveness, and cost-saving returns. Incorporate strong academic objectives. And show that you really know what you're taking on and you've got the skills to do high-quality research. We're absolutely delighted with the richness of the data that we've got and its power. So much homeless research in the UK is itsy-bitsy, 20 people here, 30 people there, and just in one city and so on. This is so much more powerful. The service relevance is another strong feature. The large sample size enables you to bring out the diversity of people. So I would urge homelessness researchers in the UK, that is, you know, in the academic area rather than the administrative research, to redirect their efforts towards large-scale studies. Lots of thanks, but they're in the presentation, and if you want to get in touch with us, those are our emails. Thank you very much.